Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time for a birding update with our regular guest, Bill Volkert. Bill, a retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist, and he's worked at the Horicon Marsh, or did work there for 27 years. He's been watching birds for well over 40 years. That's a long time. And he has authored some books on this. His latest is Journey of a Thousand Lifers. Oh, we can talk about that book a little bit too, but also talk about things that are on your mind. This is a great time of year for bird watching. What birds are you seeing in your area? What questions do you have about finding birds? I hope you'll join in the conversation. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us your question. And if you got a bird photo, you want to email that, we'd love that too. Just email it to ideas@wpr.org. And Bill Volkert, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Well, hi, Larry. Always great to be here. Thanks so much.
We had bird migration off to a slow start this spring. Did it have any effect at all? Have they made up for lost time?
Well, basically, the bird migration was just like spring, very slow. It was behind schedule. And I think the best news is that compared to last year when we had that April snowstorm, there we saw early migrants that had already arrived, and then they just got clobbered with that snow and the loss of access to food. So for early ones, robins, bluebirds, eastern phoebes, birds like that really took a hit, and we saw a real decline in those birds. Fortunately, they were all fairly common birds, and they're pretty prolific, so give them another year here and they'll make up for those losses. This year, what we were lucky was that with the cold weather and the lack of insect food out there for the songbirds, they didn't arrive. So at least they didn't get here so soon that they were running out of food at a critical time, because they expend so much energy in migration just to get here. They really need to replenish themselves. So for bird watchers, it was frustrating because you kept expecting that things would be there as normal. They were probably about a week to 10 days late throughout most of May. But we're well into the nesting season. They're making up for lost time. They're raising their families. And I think in general, we're kind of back on schedule at this point. But it was an unusual year that things were so delayed.
I know I was out for my walk run in the morning yesterday, about 5 in the morning. It sounded like, I mean, it was almost noisy out there. There was so many birds calling back and forth and chirping away. It was really a lot of fun. What are we hearing, or what are good things to be hearing this time of the year?
Well, first of all, that pre-dawn and early dawn hours get what they generally refer to as the dawn chorus, the early morning chorus. Everybody's tuning up. I think one of the reasons is the air is damp and heavy and voices carry well. There's no wind. And so if you're going to make a little noise out there, your voice will carry. Some of it is they're certainly proclaiming their territory. They're keeping the association with the mate and the nesting activity by vocal communication. And I think some people say maybe they just enjoy the early morning and are just singing because it's a nice day. There is that biology behind it. Early in spring is the establishment of territory and searching for a mate. So they're doing that by displaying visually and also calling. And then to keep that family ties going a little bit, the territory that they've claimed and the association with the mate.
So what are some birds that we would be hearing right now outside?
Well, robins are certainly very common. They love to start even before the sun comes up. They seem to be one of the early ones. You'll also hear the cardinal starting to sing. Some of the other birds like American goldfinch, and I heard as I was walking over to the studio, the house finch, they tend to sing more in the middle of the day. Yeah. Some of the forest birds, you got a little bit of stand there, the vireos, some of the warblers will be singing, house wrens, another very common one. They're all chattering away out there, so it makes a real chorus.
And we have several songs that might be kind of fun to play a few of those right now before we go to the phones and talk to Tom and Shirar and Lee. We'll get to you in just a minute, but the Red-Eyed Vireo has a pretty song.
Yes, it does. All right, let's listen to it.
Let's listen to that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So it's a whistled song, and as far as the tonal quality of it, kind of Robin-like. It's a little hard to pick out just by the quality of the voice. It's the pattern. It's this back and forth, a little phrase or mnemonic that bird watchers use is, here I am, where are you? Or I sometimes think of it as kind of an ambivalence. So what do you think? I don't know. Should we go? Yeah, maybe. Are you ready? Pretty soon. So it's this back and forth, and they just go on for the longest time. The one reason you want to know that song is because it's not a real colorful bird, and they love to be up in that middle and upper part of a tree canopy. So they really don't stand out visually. But if you listen for them, you'll know they're right up overhead.
Well, let's hear him again, Dave.
Here I am. Where are you? There you go. Pretty easy to remember.
Here I am. Where are you? Well, let's do one more before we go to the phones. How about the yellow-throated vireo? Okay, it's totally different.
It's a cousin, so he's got a little bit of that pattern. He's slower. There's a little more of a pause between it. But you notice it's also raspier. It's a harsher one.
Yeah.
The mnemonic for that, remember it, is EA38. And that EA has a little bit of a harsh roll to it.
Yeah.
And so and a little slower, a little more of a drawl.
Well, let's listen to that one.
Pretty easy, remember?
Yeah.
And the yellow-throated vireo is not as widespread or as common as red-eyed. A number of years ago, was on the threatened list. The more we looked at their population, we don't think that they quite qualified for threatened, but it is certainly a species of concern in Wisconsin, so we keep monitoring it. But as a bird, you won't encounter quite as often, but if you listen for them, they're up in those trees. They're pretty well hidden up there from view.
Let's take some calls. Tom in La Crosse will give you a chance. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. We have a tremendous problem over here with gnats and black flies, and they're so much so that they're driving young birds out of the nest way too early. Seeing a lot of dead ones around. In fact, I'm not seeing very much success nesting at all. And wondered this. You know, how's this affecting populations, if there's anything we can do about it?
Mm-hmm. Question for you, is this out of nest boxes that you're seeing it, or just
it's
birds in general?
Birds in general. I'm finding dead baby birds all over the place that are way too young to be out of their nest.
Okay. I have a feeling that probably the exceptional number of insects might be related to the wet weather that we've had this year. And so my hope is, obviously, it's going to affect nesting success and the chance to rear young if they're jumping out too early and to either find any food and find some secure shelter out there. So, no doubt if you haven't got them raising young, that'll affect the recruitment and the population for the year. I think the best hope is that it's a seasonal thing. This year is exceptional, and we get to a little more normal year. The birds will be able to, again, be more successful in raising families and bring back the numbers. But
and some birds will they not have a second clutch?
Yeah, they can try again. You will have some birds that may try early enough in the year, especially the older adults that are experienced. They may find a suitable habitat, claim that right away, get a mate, and raise a family with enough time to try a second brood in the year. Or if you have a nest failure the first time, if there's enough time in summer left, they may try again. And maybe that's the other opportunity is that maybe the insect population will dwindle a little bit more and they'll be able to pull off one more family for the year. It has also, by the way, been a problem for the whooping crane introduction over by Nisida. And this was something that was not anticipated. We've even seen this in some areas with loons. And that is that the time that they're in the height of incubation is when the black flies hatch. And it'll drive them literally off the nest just to find some peace and quiet so they're not incubating and aren't successfully hatching the eggs. So, insects can be a problem that way.
Tom, thanks. Shiar, your turn from Brookfield. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And I have observed in strange behavior between two birds along the course of Highway 41 in Wisconsin. Usually there is a larger bird, like a large bird, like a falcon or eagle flying in front, and there's a smaller bird, like a sparrow or some kind of a small black bird following this larger bird, and it seems that they make contact in the air. I don't know what's the relation between these two birds, and I've seen it very frequently. The larger bird is usually a carnivore and, you know, kind of bird that preys for other birds, but mm-hmm. I don't know why this bird is being followed by a smaller bird.
Well, very observant, yes. It's a fairly common kind of a harassment of raptors. And you'll see that in particular with red-tailed hawks, which are one of our more common hawks, especially for the open country, as they're trying to soar around and look for food or a nice place to perch to hunt from. Especially red-winged blackbirds would be very aggressive.
Yeah.
And they will attack from on top. They don't want to get down where the talons are, but they'll come from on top. They'll peck on them or just drive at them, just swooping and trying to harass the bird. And so essentially, they're just trying to keep them out of their territory. They just don't want them nearby, even if red-tailed hawks are primarily feeding on rodents. They still just don't like them. I remember Hawk on Marsh, you would watch a red tail soar over the cattail marsh or even a harrier, which was also called marsh hawk. And those poor guys, as they cross over a large area, they would go from one red-winged blackbird territory to the next to the next. And one would come up, follow him and dive at him and try to chase him out. And finally, he'd turn around, make a U-turn and go back to his territory. By that time, the next one is up. And those poor guys just had such a hard time of it. But they just don't want him in their neighborhood. We'll also see that with crows and owls. Crows see owls, they will just mob them, screech them, and reserve a very unique call, very raspy screeching call. It is referred to as the mobbing call, the mobbing behavior. And that is to get them out. So they'll harass them during the day, and then the owls will be out at night, and they'll actually even take crows off of the roost site that night. So there's this battle going on between the two.
Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Lee in Green Bay will give you a chance. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, good morning. This is a quick little story about a whippoorwill. It was the 28th of June. About 9:15 in the evening, I was in my little greenhouse out here. I have, you know, like it's wooded right along the edge of the little greenhouse. The plastic is opaque. It's white. It's not clear.
Mm-hmm.
About 9:15, I'm in the greenhouse. All of a sudden, right above me, it must have been sitting in the tree right alongside the greenhouse, a whippoorwill starts singing for anywhere from 15 to 20 seconds. It stopped. I stood there at least 10 minutes. Hoping it would sing again, it just like disappeared. You know, I didn't hear another mm-hmm. thing. And it was almost like I was dreaming that I heard that bird.
Yeah, right.
I don't hear him anymore.
You know, said June 15th?
About the 28th of, I think it was the 28th of June.
28th, so late in June.
Yeah, about 9:15 in the evening.
Sure.
About 9:15 in the evening. And I mean, where have our bobolinks went? Where have our meadowlarks gone? I don't hear the killdeers anymore like I used to. It's just, you know, it's kind of depressing is what it is.
Well, those are some good questions. I'll try to address a number of those. Whippoorwill is a bird of real concern. It is not on the endangered list for Wisconsin, but we have seen some significant declines, and we're not sure what the problem is. They're insect eaters. They feed in the evening, especially right around sunset and sunrise, and they tend to sing at those same times and sometimes throughout the evening, especially if you have a full moon. They have definitely declined in Wisconsin, and we see them. In fact, a number of states across the northern U.S. have seen the same thing. And it seems as if they're sort of, as the numbers go down, retreating toward the real core area of the best habitat. Whippoorwills still maintain themselves in southwestern Wisconsin, west central. Those seem to be some of the geographic centers. I live in the northern Kettle Moraine area. I don't hear them. They were never that abundant there, but it was something that you would occasionally hear. I have not heard, well, I think it was one in the last 12, 15 years. So, and I was a little surprised that late in June because I would expect this was a migrant coming through. Yes, we had a late spring, but even then they should have been over toward the nesting areas.
And Lee, I last week had Scott Craven on, and the story about whippoorwills came up then, mm-hmm. and we got a call from someone in Bailey's Harbor who said, "Oh man, we got them all. I'm hearing them all the time in Bailey's Harbor." So you're not too far from Bailey's Harbor.
And it may have been a bird heading that way, and it was just a little bit late on its arrival. That's why I asked the date. I would expect it maybe late May, early even into mid June. Yet a bird moving toward its nesting area, but yeah, maybe a straggler.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. And to mention about the bobolinks and the meadowlarks, I don't think there's been a real big decline of the killdeer itself, another bird that you mentioned. I think maybe some of this might be affected more with local land use issues.
Yeah.
So the population overall seems to be pretty healthy, but maybe locally we've seen some shifts and movements as land use change. The grassland birds, these are birds that we've definitely seen declines, and these were, of course, birds that are naturally attached to our native prairies.
Yeah.
We've plowed most of that under for our crops, so that certainly has led to a habitat destruction. They did very well in fallow fields and in pastures, and also the hay fields. The big impact has been twofold. One is in farming, we've seen the early hay crops, such as the clovers, alfalfas. And this was a little bit later this year, but it didn't give the birds a break because they also arrived later. Usually I see the mowing of hay in southern Wisconsin around Memorial Day. This time it wasn't until June, but of course the birds didn't initiate nesting. So now bobolinks will spend their winter in Argentina, a long flight. They don't get here until we're probably in about the second week of May, first, second week. The males arrive first, find a nice territory, look for a mate. They begin to nest, and about the time that they're even initiating nesting, here comes that hay mowing. So that's the disturbance. We did get a break for these birds under the Conservation Reserve Program, CRP, the set-aside. That created 40 million acres of grassland in our agricultural land to take the least productive land out of production, and rather than pay farmers annually for a fallowing land, these were 10-year set-asides. So we actually could establish some good permanent grass cover, and we saw a direct response. As the acreage went up, so did the birds. And then what happened was, again, changes in agriculture, especially ethanol. Farmers found that corn prices were going up, and they even were willing to pay the penalty to take that land out of its enrollment, turn it into the corn. And, of course, that's probably the worst use for a food crop, is to put it in our gasoline tanks. And we saw the birds respond accordingly. So, really, if you think about bird populations, they are an expression of the underlying landscape. They live where the habitat is good. They don't live where it isn't suitable for that species. And as land use changes, we basically have winners and losers. So as we take, say, for example, a forest, cut it down, and we plant it into grass and put in pasture, we'll have some birds move into that, find it useful, but the forest birds have lost out. And as land keeps changing, we see birds responding.
Bill Volkert, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. Talking Birds on the Ideas Network. Talking Birds today with our guest, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator, more than 40 years of watching and observing and studying birds. Bill's been at it a long time. It's great to have him with us. Questions, you can call in at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email and some photos if you got a bird photo, and we're getting a few now. It's really kind of fun to see. The idea, go to ideas@wpr.org if you want to do it that way. And Todd and Delavan did email in the past few weeks while driving to work around 5:30 in the morning. He's seen a group of turkeys hanging out with deer, three deer and five turkeys, basically in the same spot with the turkeys in the middle. Is this normal, and what are they doing together?
Well, they're associating together, but they're not after the same thing. The deer are out there doing a little bit of grazing, and turkeys, we find, will go out into these fields with their young, and they're mostly looking for insects.
Yeah.
And actually, when we first introduced the wild turkey back into Wisconsin, there were some real concerns from the farmers that they would see literally hundreds of turkeys in southwest Wisconsin where we first let them go. And then, and this would be in spring and summertime, and then in fall time, see the crop damage. And we wanted to make sure there was some research being done, because unless we found that we had kind of a buy-in and support from the farming community for the release of turkeys, we wanted to make sure before we put more turkeys around Wisconsin that there wasn't going to be a conflict. And so it was actually farmed out to University of Wisconsin that did the research, and they looked at food habits of turkeys. And so the farmers would see sometimes 300 or more turkeys in a hay field in summertime, and then notice corn damage in the fall in the field adjacent to it. What they found is they're eating primarily the grasshoppers and crickets for protein in summertime.
Yeah.
And then in that sense, they're actually doing a benefit for the farmer.
Yeah.
And when we looked at the crop damage, it was mostly deer and some raccoon. So just because you see a lot of turkeys and then you see crop damage, we can't necessarily blame them for it. And it's what it turned out to be. So the deer are doing their grazing out there. The turkeys are looking for the insects. They just happen to find good food in the same place.
I had a friend who did watch some turkeys and some deer together. And one of the turkeys got to playing with one of the young kind of fawns. You'd run at him, and then he'd run away, and then the fawn would run at the turkey,
funny games,
and then run away. So there you go. Jeff in Grand Marsh, it's your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Got a bird that resembles a sparrow, swallow.
Mm-hmm.
The nest is built on a ladder up against the wall in my barn.
Mm-hmm.
But the bird does not look like a swallow.
What is the nest?
It looks more, and I would say it's about 50% bigger than a sparrow, shaped like a sparrow, the colors of a sparrow.
What does the nest look like?
It's a mud nest.
Mm-hmm.
It's built on top of a ladder that's leaning against the wall, and it's attached to the wall and the ladder.
Well, swallows do make mud nests, and they'll take like little dabs of mud and pack that together, kind of like a mortar. The barn swallow makes a cup-shaped nest, and cliff swallows make a gourd-shaped nest. So it'll be not just open to the top, but open to the sides. So those are the very typical kind of diagnostic nests, and they tend to be somewhat colonial. You may find a kind of a pioneering pair that might build here or there, but oftentimes where you've got some really good nesting and some history of it, you'll see them just plaster these full.
I can't think of anything other than swallows that would build a nest like Jeff's describing.
Yeah, and especially as being out of mud.
Yeah.
If it's strictly mud, I would certainly say that swallow, especially barn swallow. We know robins, of course, will start with a mud base and then grass above it. And usually when we look at the bird nests, most of them will tend to have one material which they use for the foundation and another material for the lining. So the size, the construction of it, and where we find it is usually a pretty good hint of the bird that made the nest itself.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, if you've got a picture of it, or
yeah, that'd be helpful. Even just the nest picture, you don't have to have the bird on it, but
yeah, that'd be great. You could send, if you've got one, just send it into ideas@wpr.org, and we'll see if we can get an ID on it. Thanks a lot for calling, Chris in Wisconsin Rapids. Your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question on hummingbirds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We have quite a few bird feeders with different kinds of food in it, and we get pretty many birds. Early in the season, we had a few hummingbirds, but they don't seem to be around anymore. And I'm wondering if I need to move the hummingbird feeder away from the other ones.
No, you shouldn't have to move it. I mean, hummingbirds will feed. They're so quick, they'll come right in. And the food that they're looking for is different from the seed feeders that you would have nearby. I've got hummingbird oriole feeders that are right near the seed feeders, and they don't care. They're all selecting whatever they can find. My guess is that perhaps you had a migrating pair that came in early, and now that they're nesting, the nest is a little bit of a distance from the feeder itself. But as they are raising their young, and as we get into late summer, early fall, they'll be moving around, and that food will become important as they get ready for their migration. So I guess the main thing is that you just don't have a nesting pair right nearby where it's convenient between where your feeder is and where the nest is for them to come and go and take advantage of it.
Yeah. There you go. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Chris.
Also, this time of year, I'd say that there's also a lot of natural food available for them.
Yeah.
So birds are not quite as dependent on feeders, but they certainly take advantage of it as like fast food.
Let's go to Fred in Durand next. Hi, Fred.
Good morning. In May, we had a great number of grosbeaks and orioles show up mm-hmm. our backyard, and spent a lot of time putting a lot of food out for them, particularly the Oreos. I was making the solution in gallons because they were draining the feeder so quickly.
Oh, good.
But anyway, they were all around until probably second week in June, middle of June, and then they disappeared, and I assumed, well, they went to nest and raise some young. Over the last week or so, we've had the grosbeaks reappear, mm-hmm. Both the males, females, and who knows, maybe there's some of the young are there. But anyway, they're back, but haven't seen anything on the Orioles. And so I'm assuming they'll come back, but that's my question. Will they come back, or do they take off after they raise their young?
Good question. Well, you have the birds that will be hitting the feeder when they first arrive. And so Orioles and grosbeaks, the rosebreasted grosbeak, are arriving at about the same time. And that's usually the first week or so in May. This year, maybe closer to the second week. And so you may have a lot of these birds coming through as migrants, fueling up and then heading still off, whether it's a short distance or up into, say, a little farther up into Wisconsin or southern Canada to set up a territory for nesting. And I see this at my backyard, too. I have a lot more birds than that first kind of wave of migration stopping at the feeders. And then I'll have a lesser number that will actually stick around and use the local neighborhood as a nesting territory. And especially with the rose-breasted grosbeak, they were coming to the feeder quite regularly for a while. Now, not just the migrants, but also I had a pair or two that were really coming there. And I think they were really building up that energy for nesting and taking advantage of the convenient food. And they're relative to the cardinals. They also may do a little bit of what we call courtship feeding, where the male shows that he's very capable in providing and luring the mate. He'll actually grab a seed and share that with her, pass that over. So that's a nice, convenient gift there. But once they get into nesting and there's so much natural food, they're not as easily lured to the feeders. And I've been seeing my grosbeaks. Their visits have really dropped off. They just don't need the feeders that much. My Orioles, however, have just been pounding the food still. And yesterday I noticed that there were a number of fledglings out. The young were out of the nest. They're flying around. They don't seem to be quite as attracted to the feeders at this point. I think they're up in the trees looking for the insect food that's available. But they're also becoming quieter. So they're not singing the way they were in early spring as they're setting up the nesting. Now they're tending to families. They're being a little more silent. And over the next month or so, eventually they'll just slowly disappear. And so, yeah, they become a little less vocal in that midsummer.
Mark in Winneconnie, just to go along with this, emailed, you know, he feeds Orioles grape jelly throughout the summer, but doesn't know when they leave on their fall migration. If they aren't around to eat it, it ends up feeding ants and hornets. How long should he put the grape jelly out?
Well, that's always a problem from mid and late summer for the grape jelly, the hummingbird feeders. This is the time now when we get the ants and especially the hornets and wasps are coming out. So there's competition and you've got to change that food perhaps a little more often. I know I get a lot of ants that are floating around in my feeders. I try to dump them and wash it out. And of course, when you've got the yellow jackets coming to feed, I try to look for an opening so I can get in there, grab that feeder without disturbing them and try to replenish it. What I would say is leave it up over the next month. These birds will be around throughout August. And perhaps as they're getting ready for migration, they might hit that food a little bit more for an energy source. But fall migration is really different from spring. Spring, if you haven't seen an oriole or a rose-breasted grosbeak or any of those birds all year long, you notice the first one that's there. Fall time, it's more in retrospect that you realize that, well, we just haven't seen them now in a couple of weeks. As I said, they're not singing that much. They're not heard. And all of a sudden, they just seem to disappear silently. So it's a little hard to know just how fast they start to leave the neighborhood, but I'd leave the food out there as long as you think that it's still available for the birds and not just the insects as a nuisance problem.
Let's go to Fred in Watersmeet next. Hi, Fred.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
A couple questions. I'm up here in Watersmeet, but I'm from the Rapids, and I got a prairie out by Amherst.
Mm-hmm.
I have 14 bluebird houses on it. But because of a bad back, I haven't been out there. I'm wondering if anything will nest, like bluebirds in those nests, if the swallows are occupying it. Is it too late to clean the boxes? And then I came up to the cabin, up by Waters Meat and on my log cabin on the logs facing the lake. One nest was knocked down on a plastic wheelbarrow. Then I had a second nest above with one blue egg. And then I had another nest on a log above that with four blue eggs. And they're made out of grass. I think they're kind of silly to be nesting right where you're facing the lake where the storms come. Is it probably robins that I'm looking at?
Sounds like it, mud base with the grass on top. It's one of the more
blue
common
eggs.
Bird with blue eggs. There are a few other birds that certainly have bluish eggs. Catbirds have almost a greenish-blue egg, but they nest in thickets. So, yeah, my guess would be certainly robin. As far as who's using your bluebird boxes, it's always good to clean them out in springtime, especially because of the chance for some of the insects that may sit underneath that nesting material and overwinter there. So it's a sanitation thing. But the birds will, as long as it's not too packed full from the previous year, will try to take advantage of it. And you mentioned about bluebirds and tree swallows. Well, tree swallows also need some help. We've been seeing some declines there. So as far as I'm concerned, if I've got a nest box out, whether it's a bluebird or a tree swallow, I think, you know, either of them need a chance. And if you've got a lot of tree swallows, use them. Put a few more boxes out if you are looking for a carpentry project in the wintertime.
There you go. Thank you so much, Fred, for calling. Dennis in Lamira, your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. We have a cabin in Marinette County, and this year we are seeing a pair of red-headed woodpeckers mm-hmm. and a scarlet tanager.
Oh, nice.
We haven't seen them in the 18 years you've been up there. Are the red-headed woodpeckers making a comeback?
Oh, that's a good question. We definitely saw a decline of the red-headed woodpeckers, and especially in the eastern and southeastern part of Wisconsin. They are nowhere as common as they used to be, say, 25, 30 years ago. The southwestern part of the state seems to be the core area. We've got a good population. If I want to see red-headed woodpeckers, go to Nisida National Wildlife Refuge. They've done an incredible job. And, of course, with the amount of land they have in the refuge, they also have the acreage to do a very large savanna restoration. So what we mean here is grassland with scattered trees and openings. And these are really birds of the savannas. It is a woodpecker, but it's not of the dense wood interior forest. It's sort of the forest edges and the open forests. And originally in Wisconsin, we had several million acres of savanna, about 8 million it's estimated. It's one of the very endangered natural plant communities in the state. They have done a tremendous job, and they've got really quite a population. I wonder if there isn't from there kind of a spillover effect from some of those areas where they still are holding on and maybe even increasing in numbers, that we're seeing a little bit of an increase and a spillover as these birds are now moving out as the young come back again. I wouldn't say that there's a significant increase of red-headed woodpeckers in Wisconsin. There's a population trend, but they're at least holding their own at this point, and it's always a great sight. It's a beautiful bird.
And thanks again for calling. If you've got your ideas at WPR.org set up there, Bill, we've got an email and a photo from Bruce. He spotted this hawk in Ames, Iowa, on July 7th, it had a nest with a couple of chicks about 30 to 40 feet up in a maple tree. And he's wondering what kind of hawk we've got there.
Okay, the picture I'm seeing here where he's got his head turned and you're looking at the back, that is the broadwing hawk. He's got the barring across the breast, and you can just see the dark terminal band of the tail and a white band, another one. There's three broad bands when they flare and are flying around. You'll actually see that in flight. And this is one of what we call the buteo hawks, a soaring hawk, but tends to be a little bit more in the forest interior. The other one that he has is here's the same bird looking at a frontal view. You can see the barring on that chest. It looks a little, and hawks can be very difficult to sort out. At first glance, looks a little bit like Cooper's hawk with that kind of a copper, bronze or chestnut colored marking on the breast. But notice the tail is not that long, a little bulkier in the shoulders. So the Cooper's hawk has a much more longer tail, much more slender build to it. So, yeah, broadwing hawk. And that's a long-distance migrant, by the way. They spend their winter in South America. So that whole population funnels down to Texas through Mexico. They don't like to go over water, so they'll go right straight through Central America, and there's a hawk watch in Panama because it's a bottleneck. They don't want to go over the open water, so as they get into Panama, there's a pretty narrow area, and there's also a few punctuated high hills that are there, and they do a hawk watch off that, and essentially the entire North American population of broadwing hawks and from the western U.S., the Swainson's hawk, all funnel through, and we can get a really good count of the total population of birds, and then you get down to South America and just spread out there, spend the winter. So a very long migration for them.
Tim in Camp Douglas, give you a chance now. Hi, Tim.
All right. I'm curious as to how does the Baltimore Oriole make that nest that they have, and what is the material that they use? Because they all seem to be pretty consistent with the same type of a material used.
Yeah, the best way to find the oriole nest, for me anyway, is in wintertime. They do a nice job of hiding them. They love to build them at the very end of the small twigs and branches. And so if you've got these drooping branches and all those leaves, they really pack it in there. And it's a woven nest. So they'll look for the fine twigs and then weave it around there as a basket. And people have actually watched them build it. And they seem to have this instinct of knowing to loop and to tie these together as a weaving. Very meticulous. Some people have put out little pieces of yarn for them. They'll weave that into there, make a colorful nest out of it. But mostly they're stripping grasses. So they'll come down to the ground, which I noticed that this spring, because I had orioles very active right around the house. Normally I think of them as a bird of the middle and upper part of the trees, but here they are right on the ground, and they're looking for that nest material and stripping this stuff, fly up, and they'll start to weave it. And there's a number of birds in that family. They're actually in the blackbird family that make woven nests. So the orioles are certainly known as the weavers. And then as you get into Central South America, there's a much larger relative called the Oropendula. They'll weave nests that'll be 5-6 feet long. And they do it as colonies. And just amazing. So, yeah, that's a really quite an art for them.
I was lucky enough. Our home, this is a few years back now, our home on Lake Monona, a pair decided to build a nest on the birch tree in our backyard, and we had wide open windows there so we could watch that whole process.
Oh,
and
nice.
Watch how long that nest survived some terrible...
It'll hang on through the whole winter time.
Oh,
yeah.
The whole winter.
Quite a construction job.
I was really amazed. Tim, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network. We're talking about birds on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator. Always great to have him come by. And certainly if you have questions, I hope you'll join in. Bill, one of my favorite sightings always is to see an indigo bunting. They're a beautiful bird.
Blue is not a common color among birds.
Right.
And they express such a deep, vivid blue. It's just a knockout.
And they have a good song, too.
Yes, very diagnostic.
Let's listen. That's pretty.
It's kind of rapid, but what you'll notice, if you listen close, two notes, they're kind of bubbly. It'd be two up, down, up, down, down, up. So it's always repeated as two, as this little up and down warble to it. And indigo bunting is another one of those birds. They love to hide up in the middle upper part of the trees. Now, I know for most people, the sighting of indigo bunting is just spectacular in spring. They'll come and hit the feeders right away, and then they seem to disappear. And I, over the years, have had a lot of people ask me, where do they all go? I see them for 2 weeks at my feeders in spring, and then they're gone. They just move into the trees. And blue is not created as by a pigment. There's no such thing as a true blue color. This is reflected light. And so bluebirds, blue jays, indigo buntings, this is the microstructure of the feathers that breaks apart that light and reflects blue.
Oh.
So when he's sitting at a feeder in front of you, that light's coming over your shoulder and reflecting back. When he sits up on the telephone or power lines or up in the tree, the sun's behind him or he's in the shadow. He looks black. So you don't see that color. That's why you need to know that song. So listen again. Parrot's notes, up, down, up, down. Kind of cheerful, bubbly song.
And if you want to scroll down on your iPad there, the caller earlier who had the nest.
Oh, here we go.
In the sitting on the ladder in his barn, sent us a photo.
Yeah, very nice. That looks like barn swallow to me. It's a cup shape. It's all mud. And just trying to look at that little part of the ladder, the scale of it, that certainly would be. And it would make sense near a building called barn swallow because they will build in barns because we don't always close all the doors. So they've got access in and out. They've got a roof over their head and around those feeding lots and so forth. There's plenty of insects for them. So, it's always nice to have them around because they'll keep the insects down. Very good.
Let's go to Dan in Cross Plains next. Hi, Dan.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
About 5 years ago, AT&T put up a new cell tower right in town in Cross Plains. And about a year later, that first spring, I was driving by, and there was something unusual at the very top of the tower. And I stopped and looked and realized that it was a turkey vulture with its wings fully extended.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and since then, every spring, early summer, the flock has been getting bigger and bigger. And just this morning, there was at least 15, maybe 16 up there. They don't all have their wings extended.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just a quite an interesting
kind of an eerie sight, isn't it?
Yeah, almost. Yeah.
About, must have been 3 weeks ago, there was a crew working on the tower. And so I drove back and talked to one of the technicians, and he was on the ground, and I asked him about that, and he said that it's quite a mess up there, he said.
Yeah, they're not just perching up there, but they're leaving their droppings on everything.
Yep, absolutely. And he
what if that interferes with the signal?
probably not, but it could. I mean, it's all digital, and who knows what could it do or what that could do to the bird.
Yeah.
But anyhow, he said that there were three technicians working up there on top of the tower. The tower's 155 feet, and the technicians were up there working, and he said that if they're, you know, doing something small and not making a lot of movement,
mm-hmm.
those birds will come in and land. As soon as they move their head or shoulder, the bird will take off.
Oh, sure.
Kind of thing. So what's your thought on what attracted them to that particular tower?
Well, they're looking for a nice exposed perch. And actually, I've noticed in my neighborhood, the vultures have just exploded in the last 10 years or so. It's not unusual to see right around my house, especially in the evening when they're coming into the roost site, 30, 40, and I've already counted, especially spring and fall, over 100 of them circling overhead. And what I notice from my house, there's one very large prominent tree right out in front of our house. It's the tallest tree in the woods, and the top is dying. They use that sometimes as an overnight roost site, or they'll move somewhere else to find a tree. They want looking for a large branch tree as a place to spend the evening. And a lot of times they'll fly to that tree in front of the house in the morning. It's open, exposed, it catches the early sun. They're warming up and they also are drying off because of the dew that collects on the feathers. And so when you see them with their wings out, they're drying themselves off and catching a little bit of those early sun rays in the morning time. And they don't flap their wings a lot. They're waiting for that warm air to rise and to be riding on the thermals and the winds. So they want to get some of that moisture off themselves and wait for it to heat up. So they're coming out for the morning and just waiting for the sun to get a little higher and for the warmth to start to create those thermals for them. And then they'll go out soaring. Now, of course, they eat on carrion. So it's all dead stuff out there they're feeding on. They are the garbage crew. They're the cleanup crew. And if you just look around Wisconsin, there is just an abundance of food. Just travel around and look at any rural highway or even along the freeways. The number of dead deers and small mammals, the raccoon, possum, skunk, squirrels, rabbits that are being hit, that's all food for them. Just a little side story. I remember one year I was down in Texas at Big Bend, and as I was looking out, here was this vulture down in the plains and just following this course and making little turns left, right, and it's wide open desert. And I thought, this seemed to be an odd course that he was following. As I got down a little farther down the hill, I realized, oh, that's the highway down there. And that must have been his morning routine. Soar along the highway, he had his stretch, looked to see what was being hit overnight and see if there's any fresh food out there. And as I say, we've got just an abundance of food for them. And vultures, yeah, we've got certainly good populations. But those are the either evening roost site or the morning where they're getting out to kind of greet the sun before it warms up.
There you go, Dan. Thank you for calling. Cheryl in Berlin, it's your turn. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. I would like to know why the birds won't use my hanging aluminum bird bath.
A hanging bird bath. Is it out in a fairly visible area, open enough for them to see, for one? You want to have something that is pretty visible. Or are there other water sources nearby? Maybe they're just taking advantage of that. Bathing is something that birds will do occasionally. It's not as, say, necessary or attractive as food might be for them. It may not be something that is directly drawn, or maybe you want to move it to a little different area where it's a little more visible to the birds. Yeah. Also in summer, if you've got water out there, make sure you change it regularly. Mosquitoes will hatch out in about 7 to 10 days. Yeah. So you want to change that periodically and also make sure there's no algae building up in there.
And thanks for calling. Richard in West Bend, hello.
Yes, good morning.
Hi there.
We have a maple tree outside of our house, and we watch the birds on the feeders and so forth. And the other day, a bird landed in the tree, and instead of hopping like most birds do, he walked. Mm-hmm. Up and down the branches, but he strolled just like he was walking. Most unusual. Maybe there are birds that do that, but it seemed unusual.
Yes, there are birds that will hop and those that will walk. So we'll commonly see song sparrows, robins. They tend to hop as their locomotion on the ground. Grackles and some of the other blackbirds will do more of a walking. So, yeah, there are different modes. Of course, pigeons and doves, they tend to walk rather than hop.
Ducks, of course, refer to as wobble.
Yeah. I would probably guess it'd be one of the blackbirds.
Yeah.
Just in considering how common and widespread they are, probably the most likely, but certainly doesn't have to be.
All right. There you go, Richard. And Bob and Krivitz, hello.
Good morning. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Can you hear me okay? Yeah, okay. Okay, the gentleman that called in about red-headed woodpeckers?
Yes.
Okay. I'm in Marinette County. I'm over by Cauldron Falls. Okay, and I started feeding them about 4 years ago. I built a platform feeder, and I stuck a 4x4 in the ground. Okay, and it's about 8 inches square. Because they would fly around, but they would not go to any other feeder. I started putting whole kernel corn up there. I've got them in here every year. This morning I had 6 of them in here at the same time.
Oh, very good. Nice. Nice for you. Are you seeing any young this year? They'll not have the red head. They'll have that grayish-brown head.
No, I have not yet this year.
Okay.
But I have most other years. Mm-hmm. Okay, and the bear used to snap off this 4x4. You know, it was stuck in the ground. Okay, so I put a railroad tie under it, cut a hole in it, I put it in there, and he tips it over at night, and I stand it up in the morning.
Well, nice that you're hosting red-headed woodpeckers. As we said earlier, it's not a widespread bird in Wisconsin. Sounds like your area, you've got a little bit of a core population there. Good. Let's keep them going.
Yeah. And speaking of birds that have come up here, whippoorwills, we've been getting emails. Linda in Whitewater said in the Driftless area, she's happy to report she heard meadowlarks every single day, and somebody else said they have meadowlarks that are coming to theirs. And whippoorwills. Laura emailed Lake Tomahawk. She hears whippoorwills all the time.
Yeah, that central forested area of Wisconsin, the southwest, west central, that seems to be probably the most reliable area for whippoorwills in Wisconsin.
Kate in Menominee, Michigan. Hi.
Hi. Hello.
Yeah, what's on your mind, Kate?
Well, about a month ago, you had a show where you were talking about the whooping cranes that you released so many of them in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I travel around, I'm in Michigan, I travel around Michigan, and today I'm in Menominee, and that's when I heard the show. I love the show on Wednesdays. Anyway, as I was traveling north, I looked over to my right, and there stood a whooping crane.
Oh, very nice.
And today, I was south Escanaba, just south Escanaba, not too far south, and I saw a pair flying.
Oh,
very good.
A wonderful sight, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Now, these are birds that do not mature for a number of years. So as we release them, it'll take several years before they're old enough to select the mate. And a lot of the young ones, when they come back, they may not always come right back to their ancestral area. We have led them south with the ultralights in the past. And with that, if you just show them how where to go south, they tend to find their way back to where they were hatched out. But there's oftentimes the reports of birds that do get off course, and especially the young ones when they're first wandering around. Maybe they get caught up in the winds or just start going and don't know when to stop. So, yeah, we have had a number of reports of these birds outside of the original release range. And hopefully when they mature, they'll come back to that core nesting area.
Bill Volkert, our guest today, he'll be with us right up to 12:30 today as we talk birds with him. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or send your photos or emails to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. We'll take a quick look at the news and weather, and then we will be back. So you stay with us. Taking a look at birds today on the Ideas Network, I'm Larry Mueller. My guest, Bill Volkert, a retired wildlife DNR educator. Lots of experience with birds, and it's always fun to have him with us. And hope you'll join in with your questions or comments, or shoot us an email and maybe a bird photo. We've got quite a few of those we can talk about as well. And Bill, I know you're going to be leading a trip to Nicaragua, are you not?
Yes, we've done that for several years. Last year, because of some of the political unrest, I postponed it. It was never dangerous for tourists, but I just figured people felt a little uncomfortable, so we put that off. Looks like things have settled down, and we're going to give this another try. It's a country that certainly needs a boost with its ecotourism. I've been working there since about 2002 on a variety of conservation projects. Of course, we'll also see not just the exotic birds of the tropics, but also where our birds winter. Rose-breasted grosbeaks, orioles, they're all down there for the wintertime. So in February, I'll be taking a group of only 10 people, and this will be February 9 through 18. And information and complete itinerary is on my website. So if anybody's interested, they can just go to BillVolkert.com.
BillVolkert.com, and it's February, so a little time yet to get signed up.
Oh, yes, yeah. Plenty of time. I just got some of the information out within the last few weeks. I've got a few people signed up and others interested, but there's still plenty of space. And I also find that there's a lot of people that have expressed interest in the past but haven't even responded. I think they're just out enjoying summer and probably put it aside for a while before they really think seriously about what they want to do with their winter plans. But, you know, first come, first serve. If people want to come and join us and do a little bit of birding, it's a great time of year. It's their driest month in Central America. It's also a time when I think winter gets a little old, so it's great to get away.
Yeah.
And we'll show you around to some of the best birding places in the country.
There you go. And it's BillVolkert.com.
Yeah, easy to find. If you know my name, you can find my website. And to help them, I also wrote a book a number of years ago, Where to Watch Birds in Nicaragua. So that's where we started doing the tours.
Very good. There we have it. And the book you can get online as well.
Yeah, I have the book online. And as you mentioned at the outset, my recent book, Journey of a Thousand Lifers, which is a summary of the 7.5-month round-the-world birding trip that my wife and I took a few years ago. That's also available. And I realized just recently that the contact section on my website, I had a little bit of technical problems, so somebody called my attention that they weren't getting through. That's all been fixed now, so at least
there
that's taken care of. So, yeah, feel free if they want to get in touch with anything regarding birds, the trip, or books, they can contact me there.
Let's take a call next. Lynn in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Lynn.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I have a question. I just spent a month in northern Illinois, or near DeKalb, And it's been wet, and there's no crops in, and I understand it's all the way from southern Illinois up to here. How is that going to affect? And I notice often that there's cranes and geese and heron feeding in those fields. What are the weather conditions? How is that going to impact our bird buddies?
Yeah, good question. While corn is something that the sandhill cranes and Canada geese and blackbirds will take advantage of, it's just simply because it's so widespread, but it's not a food source they're directly dependent on. So as far as food for them, I don't think that's really going to be a serious problem. The bigger problem, of course, for the farmers themselves, such a wet year, they're very late to get crops into the ground. In some places, they may still be saturated. And especially with the flooding we saw out in Iowa and along the Mississippi River drainage, somebody asked me the question a while ago, what is that doing to birds? I think some of the late flooding probably drowned out a lot of the ground nesting birds, especially waterfowl. Fortunately, these birds can re-nest, so they may have just simply moved to higher ground. Weather is always a problem for birds. They're certainly out there in nature, and as nature throws things at them, sometimes it does cause some problems for them. I think the bigger issue is they've always had to deal with exceptional years and exceptional weather events. That's always been part of nature. But as we use more land for ourselves and constrain birds to smaller areas, it becomes a little more exacerbated in terms of the impact for them. And so with that, as birds are already under other stresses, nature can add to that. I would never say that nature was the sole source of problems for the birds. You know, let's blame ourselves for that. But it does become a little bit more of a problem for them as we squeeze them into smaller places.
Tim emailed that he lives about 7 miles from Ashland, and he saw a western tanager. What would cause it to be so completely out of range? He had a photo. It was May 24th, I believe.
There were a number of sightings of western tanager in Wisconsin this spring. Also very unusual, several painted buntings. They were sighted in 6 counties. We had a black-throated gray warbler. That was seen here, some good sightings of summer tanagers. So these are birds that are not regularly found in Wisconsin. Western tanager, as the name implies, is a bird from out west. Summer tanager is a bird that is found more commonly south of Wisconsin, southern Illinois, into the Ozarks, Missouri. We will get them trickling up here occasionally, not really a regular nesting bird. The painted bunting is more common in the south and especially the southeastern part of the U.S. We're a little far north for them, but for some reason, they got caught up in those weather systems. And as I always say, you know, birds fly and they do have this homing instinct. So they'll come back to the same place every year. But also in flights, they do sometimes get blown off course. And that makes it oftentimes intriguing for the bird watchers to see the exceptional birds that show up. And this is a great sighting as a backyard bird, a western tanager. I also see another posting you have of summer tanager.
Yeah.
And looking at that picture, it lacks the deep scarlet orange color. It's more of a rosy red and does not have the contrasting black wing. And the bill is not dark, but more of an ivory color. So
yeah,
that's another
Bobby,
great bird. In southern Wisconsin in particular, and there have been some sightings even into the northern part of the state. These are birds to be watching for that will get a little off course or just start wandering around a little bit and show up in who knows where, sometimes your own backyard.
Jim in Amro, thank you for calling.
Thank you. Great show. My question is about suet.
Mm-hmm.
Should I be feeding my birds suet in the summer, and is there a summer and or winter blend for that product?
Oh, good question. Suet, you can buy it in cakes. It's sometimes available in some of the stores, sort of pre-packaged, pre-made. They oftentimes mix a little bit of seed in with it. You can make your own by simply collecting the drippings from, say, ground beef, let it solidify. Oh, years ago, I just took a log, bored a couple of 1-inch holes and just smeared it in there like peanut butter. Watch out for bacon drippings because it's quite salty. So that's a bit of a concern. Yeah, don't have too much salt in there for the birds. The other kind of suet is what you can just get from the butcher, which is the tallow, just from the fatty material that is generally discarded, and you can get that. The problem with the drippings is when it's this hot outside, it's just going to get to that melting point and just run. The other problem with the tallow type or some of the cakes with, the warm weather, you leave it out there, and if the birds aren't eating real actively on it, it can start to spoil on you. Winter, it'll keep forever. It just basically freezes, and it's a great attractant, especially for the woodpeckers. And oftentimes in spring, you may even see some of the warblers coming to it, very unusual like.
So, but nothing that is winter and
winter,
summer,
no difference. There's no, different blend or anything.
Okay.
I think more than anything in summertime, it's more the tallow or the cakes, just because the other stuff just runs too much.
There you go, Jim. Thanks. Jane in Random Lake, your turn. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I was wondering if you could help me identify this bird by its call.
We'll give her a try. Is something that you hear quite commonly? Mm-hmm. Okay.
No, I heard it one time.
Well, play it again. Let's listen to it again.
It's coming.
Hmm. Oh, very nice.
What the heck could that be? I'm not sure we heard the whole song. That's the problem. Was that the whole song?
Yeah. Two-note call.
Two-note call. It's an abbreviated song. Give me a second here. I do know that. It's not the typical full song of the bird. And I'm trying to roll that around my head. Let's move on to something else. I'll get that.
Play it once more, Jane, if you can.
Yeah.
Can't play it again. That's all right.
Yeah, that's okay. I know it. And I know that song. it's not something I have in my neighborhood. So I don't hear that.
And Jane,
somebody else may be quicker on it than I am. But
hang in there, Jane. We'll try and come up
with it.
We'll
get it before the hour's up.
Rick in Belleville, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Say, Bill, I've got a hypothetical here. I know it's probably not totally kosher what we've done, but down at the farm about 3 weeks ago, a fledgling blue jay came hopping out of the woods into the barnyard into the grass and just about jumped into my hand. And knowing that the parents were probably around and his best bet was to be, raised by the parents. We put him back in the woods, and two different times he came popping back out of the woods into the barnyard, and we knew he wasn't going to do well. So actually took him in. We've got an indoor screen or an outdoor screened-in porch, and he's been raised there. He's doing great. Now he looks like a adult blue jay flying around, and it would be the equivalent of an outdoor avium for him. So anyway, now he'll jump on my wife's shoulder, and he's eating right off of a straw, and he's not tame, but he wants to go out. But the question I have for you is, what should be we're ready to let him go, but I'm not sure if he's going to make it, because I know that the Jay families raise their adolescents into the fall, and they stay with them. Now, he doesn't have that. There's a lot of birds around the woods, around the farmyard, but what do you think about the timing to let him go and give him a shot on his own?
Okay, now he's eating the seeds and whatever else you're offering him?
Yeah, he's eating mealworms.
Good high protein food.
Peanuts, I read that cat or dog food mashed up, which we've given. He just ravenously just eats that with peanuts on top of it. He's grown and eats like a horse, and basically kind of making a mess. But he's kind of becoming a little bit of the family, and we need to get him on his way. So
try to limit the human contact so he doesn't become too associated with people. Try to keep him wild if you can. And what I would do is I would keep the food right inside there, open the door, and then offer the same food right outside. And that way he at least knows to come back a bit, that the food is there, sort of a slow release, and offer it right outside, see if he at least knows that there's another food source available. And as we get into fall and they start flocking, hopefully he'll start to associate with other of his kind. They may stay around through the entire winter, especially in southern Wisconsin. There is a migration of blue jays as they vacate some of the more northern counties in southern Canada. Let's try that. I understand your intentions, trying to help him out, and that's certainly commendable. I will say that technically, by the federal laws, we shouldn't be keeping without permits. But again, I understand your intentions there. Yeah, try to get him out into the wild as best you can. I would try a little bit of a slow release. Open that door up and leave some food inside there for him. Let him leave at his own accord, and also offer some food.
There we go. Good luck, Rick. Thank you very much. For next time Bill's on, you're going to have to give us a report.
Yeah.
There you go. Lori in Wisconsin Dells. Hi.
Yes. First of all, wasn't that a Bob White?
Which? Oh, yeah. There, you're right. And you're correct. It is Bob White. And
now we're talking about that bird, that one bird song. Yeah.
And I was wondering why I couldn't place it, because I actually haven't heard it in the wild for a number of years. And the Bob White population is seriously declining, not just Wisconsin, but they're more common in the southeastern U.S. And even there, there's been a major initiative among a variety of conservation groups to try to bolster those populations. They used to be very common around the hedgerows within farmland. And, of course, as we've gone to larger scale farming and more monotypic crops, they've lost that habitat. Yeah, I actually have not heard Bob White in the wild in, oh my gosh, a good 10 years. I usually go over toward Wyalusing, and I can sometimes, Richland County seems to be kind of the last stronghold for them. And I remember years ago, a DNR tried working with private landowners to create some habitat out there and provide something for them. But even there, they didn't seem to respond quite as much as we'd hoped to. And yeah, that's a bird that's really been disappearing. And obviously, my recollection of its call has been disappearing too. I just haven't heard it in the longest time. Yeah.
Lori, you had something else too.
My comment didn't really have to do with the Bob White.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks.
That was extra for free.
Good. You rattled my brain there. Thank you.
When you were talking about the hummingbird feeders and the ant problem,
mm-hmm.
I discovered something that works on my shepherd's crook where my hummingbird feeder hangs, is if I take a little bit of coconut oil and put it on my finger
mm-hmm.
and just do the edge of the shepherd's crook where just before my hummingbird feeder hook goes on,
okay.
and then I even do it around the very top of the hummingbird feeder, the ants will not cross that coconut oil.
Oh. Keeps them away, and it still makes it available for the hummingbirds. So there you go.
And it's just a smear of it.
Yeah.
You know, just like if you sprayed it with
insect repellent or something
like
that.
Yeah. But it's the coconut oil, and I put it on there, and I tell you, the ants ran the other way, and I haven't had ants in my hummingbird feeder since.
Oh, I have to try that when I get home, because, yeah, they're just starting to show up in numbers around our feeders.
Coconut oil.
Yeah,
thank you, Lori.
Yeah, appreciate that.
She had a couple of good tips
thanks
for
both of those.
Thanks again.
I should also mention with Bob Whites, we will occasionally see them in Wisconsin here and there out of what would even be decent habitat for them, but those are game farm releases, escapees.
Yeah, there we go. Richard and Ettrick, hello.
Hey, great show.
Thank you.
I got a question about bobolinks.
Mm-hmm.
I farm over by Ettrick, and one of my hayfields is nice, flat, grassy, and I had bobolinks nesting in there pretty much every year. And I usually leave about 4 acres standing for them to nest. I checked the fields a few days ago, and mm-hmm. it looked like they were kind of gone. So then I cut it. What time of year do they normally start heading out?
Well, the general rule of thumb, and this gets to be difficult for farmers who are, of course, trying to make the land work for them, but general rule of thumb for grassland habitat is if you can, don't cut anything before July 1st, and if you can wait a little longer, July 15th. And that's usually about the time, even for late nesting grassland birds, to have raised those young and get them to fledging stage where they can move around and are no longer tied to that nest. So that's general rule of thumb. 4 acres, it may have been that it was suitable for nesting, but they're moving around now looking for other places to feed. They won't be heading south for some time yet, more than a month before they head out. But I'm guessing it's more local movement for them. But I appreciate you giving them a little bit of habitat out there.
Absolutely. Yes. Thanks, Richard. Appreciate it very much. Let's take a call from Howard in Pine River.
Oh, good afternoon.
Hi there.
Our home is in the middle of a pretty good-sized woodlot, and this year I've been noticing a lot of yellow-billed cuckoos. We used to call them rain crows when I was a kid.
Hmm.
And I'm wondering if they are making a comeback, because I don't remember hearing so many of them in the past few years.
Well, they're not making a comeback. They are a bird that populations have declined. They're also a very long-distance migrant. They'll go well into South America. And I've actually saw a yellow-billed cuckoo in Bolivia.
Ah.
So this is a long flight for them. But cuckoos have this unusual habit that populations will move around with hatching of the big colonies of caterpillars, especially tent caterpillars. How they know where they're going to be outbreaking and how they all move, still a mystery. But yeah, we will see them shift a little bit with some of the available food. So no, it's not a very common bird. It may be kind of an annual thing that they just happen to have an abundant food source that they took advantage of this year. Great that you have them in the area. And between the black and yellow-billed cuckoo, they're best identified by their call. There's a good-sized bird, but when they get up into a tree, they don't move much. They'll just sit there. And I've oftentimes had them calling and try just craning my neck to get a look at them. So they can be quite secretive. But good for you for having them. I'll see what happens for next year, but I don't expect that necessarily to be back in the same numbers. As I say, they're somewhat nomadic.
And thanks again for calling, Howard. Appreciate it. You know, we've got a call. The wood thrush is another interesting call. And I know Dave Poltratz, our engineer, has that up.
One of my favorites. I think anybody who listens to birds, this is one of the best.
I love that sound.
Yeah, isn't that beautiful? A little mnemonic to remember it, Eole. And it's very flute-like, little ring to it. It's a woodland bird, and so this is a bird that loves those deeper forests, especially in southern Wisconsin, northern Illinois. It doesn't get up way into, say, far northern Wisconsin. It's more replaced by hermit thrush there, and as we get into Canada, the Swainsons and gray-cheeked thrushes are replacing it as we get into different forest type. It is a bird that has been declining in numbers. It is not on the endangered or threatened list for Wisconsin, but it is a bird of concern, and it's something that we always listen for. One reason why I wanted to bring up the wood thrush is I had one singing in my backyard around the neighborhood in May, and this happens almost every year by me. And then they seem to move and find a different area, and then usually end of June, early July, I'll hear one. These are what we call floaters. These are the males that were probably unsuccessful, and they just keep moving around throughout that late spring and summer, hoping yet they're going to attract the female somewhere. And I posted something in the Wisconsin Bird Network, the online discussion group, about it, and a number of people wrote back, said, yeah, one just showed up recently and I had him singing. So there's a beautiful song, but it also means it's probably not a successful nester for this year. But listen to it again. Eole, little flute-like. And that also brings to mind the serious conservation issues for birds that are declining. If something like this did disappear from the woods, and if we didn't do enough now, what would the woods be like if we'd never hear that again?
Yeah.
So let's do what we can, keep birds there. And remember, we've got to not only protect the birds in their tropical nest, wintering grounds where they will travel to and make sure they can survive. This is the only place they nest, so we're responsible for them here in Wisconsin and these northern states for these birds making these thousands of mile flights to raise their families, be successful, keep the populations going, and of course, with increasing impacts on the land, they also need safe stopovers in between. We've got to protect them up north, down south, and everywhere in between so they can keep coming and going every year with the seasons.
And Bill, on that note, we are out of time. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Always a pleasure.
Sure he'll be back, and we will do this all over again with him, Bill Volkert. If you were interested in looking at one of his books or thinking about that trip to Nicaragua in February, go to BillVolkert.com, and you'll find more information about the trip and about his books. So he'll be back, and we'll talk with him again about birds. Always a lot of fun to have him with us. Tomorrow we talk home improvement with Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build, and also Sam Breidenbach to talk about general home renovation and restoration. So join us tomorrow for that. But hey, in the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.